I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest, psychologist Madeline Levine, has been sounding the alarm for years about parents putting unreasonable expectations on their children to get straight A's, play varsity sports, build out that high school resume, and get into an elite college. With her books, The Price of Privilege and Teach Your Children Well. She says the impulse to overmanage our children's everyday lives and to shelter them from the consequences of ever making a mistake or being upset ends up undermining them, leading to anxiety and depression and the inability to lead productive, healthy, and satisfying lives as adults. Levine has a private practice in California talking with children and teenagers about why they feel so stressed and so unhappy. Her new book, Ready or Not, is about the pressures of living in a competitive, ever-changing, and uncertain world and what parents can do to give their kids the emotional tools to survive, maybe even thrive. Madeline Levine is co-founder of Challenge Success, which is affiliated with Stanford Graduate School of Education, and joins us here in our studio. Nice to have you back with us Radio Times. Your book got me thinking about my childhood and the kinds of anxieties. I think you and I are probably around the same age. The kinds of anxieties that I had as a kid with duck and cover, the threat of nuclear annihilation. I remember feeling that as a child. Later on, three assassinations. And we can go on and on from there about living in an uncertain world. What is unique about today's anxieties that parents and children are feeling?
So it's interesting. The original subtitle for the book was supposed to be Preparing Children to Thrive in an Uncertain World. And I didn't like it because the world's always uncertain. And the point you're making is well taken. So we've always had uncertainty. But however, by the way, when we were doing duck and cover, which I did as well, we didn't have 24-hour news feeding us imagery of nuclear holocausts all the time. And there wasn't at that point. Kids now have, and parents have, that 24-hour loop. And we know that people who watch more of disturbing images believe the world is more disturbing, whether it is or isn't. And often,
but they feel that way.
But they feel that way. So, for example, people think that crime is up. They don't want their children biking around the neighborhood. They might be abducted. They don't want their kids walking to school anymore. I walked to school. Did you, Marty?
I did.
Yeah. And the fear of abduction or violence is unfounded statistically. So I think I think it's very different than when we were kids. However, but it was uncertain, and it's always uncertain.
Some of it real and some of it not real.
Correct. But what is really different is the velocity of change. So, you know, people always say, well, like the Industrial Revolution, there was a lot of change. There was, but it took place over 100 years. I feel like I'm living change on this book tour because the last time, which wasn't that long ago, 6 years ago, I didn't do podcasts. I didn't, you know, so like the means of communication have changed incredibly quickly in a few years. iPhone came out, I think, in 07, and there was 50% of people had it within a couple of years. So I do think what's different about it is how quickly things are changing. And what we know about how the brain works when things are changing really quickly is that it gets nervous and tends to look backwards, become conservative, look backwards for solutions, which are exactly the wrong kind of thing to do when things are changing rapidly. You got to look forward.
I do want to get to that, but you also write, for most kids, having something resembling an old-fashioned childhood, playing outside, meeting challenges without constant parental interference, being bored, having chores, taking some risks, is far more likely to build the kind of competencies kids have always needed and will particularly need in the future. So there are things from the past that we should not forget about.
Oh, right, right. But, you know, so let me give you an example of what I mean by that.
Sure.
Often I'll talk to parents about why they're pushing their kid for perfect grades in a selective school, and they'll say, well, Brown worked for me, or Columbia worked for me, or Harvard worked for me, so it will work for my kid. We tend to use solutions that had worked previously for us, and that may or may not be what works for your kids. As a matter of fact, talking to CEOs, there's a whole bunch of other skills that look to be more valuable going forward. Yes, I have. I think my New York Times review said I have a certain nostalgia for the past. and I think that we underestimate exactly how much kids learn from things like play. I was watching a couple of kids the other day in a playground playing tag, and it looks like nothing's happening. They're just running around. But in fact, it's almost like everything you need to learn in life, you can learn through tag. It's two people. If you don't collaborate, there's no game. If one kid says, I'm out of here, there's no game. Who's the leader? Who's the follower? All in the context of what looks like play but is actually social skill learning. And I think, you know, we know, for example, Challenge Success, we do a lot of research on schools, that academic-based preschools, 3 years later, those kids academically are not doing as well as kids who go to play-based preschool. So there's something about addressing the developmental need appropriately, which I think we're losing track of.
Well, reading your book, on the one hand, there is this protectiveness. I mean, I think parents generally want to make sure their children are safe, but that's combined with a kind of perfectionism. So it's this rather, I would say, mixed message that a lot of parents are giving their children.
Right. So, I mean, you make a great point that parents want to protect their children. Of course we want to protect our children. But what exactly does that mean, to protect your children? So I think there are all different kinds of protection. Car's coming and you put your kid away. He's being bullied or she's being bullied at school. You might address that with the school. Those kinds of really life-threatening or psychologically really threatening things are things parents have to do. My take right now is that parents, because they know their kids are so stressed, are trying to accommodate to their kids' stress, but in all the wrong ways. So from my point of view, and again, the research we have at Stanford says the greatest source of stress for children is school. Now, no, that was never the case. It used to be mom and dad are fighting, or dad's an alcoholic, whatever. Those were the things that stress kids, or I'm not popular, nobody sits with me. But now it's school.
And so, school, getting grades, doing well, taking the right courses, all
right,
that.
The pressure. And affluent kids have just been – kids from affluent families have just been declared an at-risk group by World Health because their rates of anxiety are so high. The place where we ought to concentrate is there too much homework? Is my kid getting enough sleep? Are they overscheduled? Are they on social media too much? Those are the areas where we really could make a difference. But I think what's happening is parents are afraid to intervene in those areas because they're still of that, well, Brown was good for me. Or in my own family, I'm a psychologist, got good grades, went to school. I'm a psychologist, you know, 40 years later almost. My husband's a surgeon, went to school. That was what was needed then. That's really not what's needed now. We need a different skill set. We need different capacities, I think.
Well, it's so interesting because in certain ways, a lot of the families that you have worked with are well-to-do families. And in many ways, you would think being well-to-do, having money, is going to protect you from the true anxieties of life. And there are children growing up in this country who, you know, do fear for their lives going to school.
Right.
You know, their neighborhoods are dangerous, or sometimes things are dangerous at home. Those are real dangers. But if we're talking about this subset of very wealthy people, you know, the 1%, if you will, they should be protected from some of these anxieties. And yet you're saying they're feeling it more than ever.
Yeah, they're feeling it more than ever. And interestingly, their rates of they're different groups. So kids from poverty or under-resourced communities really have fear, and their parents have fears about life and putting food on the table. And so their rates of behavioral problems tend to be higher. Their rates of substance abuse are lower. Rates of depression are higher. Rates of anxiety disorders are lower. So, you know, it's not – you can't – all kids who are having trouble, from my point of view, deserve to be looked at and helped. And, you know, when we first started this of looking at kids, both from public and private school, 50-50, there was blowback again about what are you doing with kids who have resources. And historically, having a family with resources and educated parents was protective. We saw lower rates in that group.
And so what happened to bring this anxiety and this perfectionism, it seems, at these sort of high-functioning families?
Right. So, you know, I think the bifurcation of the economy had something to do with it, or had a lot to do with it. You're a winner or a loser. I mean, it's really clear. Middle class is shrinking. If you have some resources, you really want to make sure your kids have benefits. Now, the idea of what constitutes a benefit, you know, it's not Varsity Blues scandal paying your kids way into college. That's really not a benefit. But it has been a real shift in the protective value of coming from a resourced family. So they're anxious about their kids continuing to do well. I think the 24-hour news cycle mm-hmm. has a lot to do with everybody's anxiety and misperception of what's, like, accurate. You know,
is it also competitiveness just gone berserk?
There's a lot of things that have gone berserk in this country, from my point of view, including what constitutes true information. And so, you know, we have a lot of information on what makes kids do better emotionally. And this kind of stepping in for normal developmental challenge, right? You have a kid. I raised three kids. You raised how many?
Just one.
Okay, so we got four kids. I don't love getting older. I like the fact that my kids were raised before this became so competitive and so anxiety-ridden. It's taken so much, I think, of the joy. This intensive parenting has taken joy out of raising a family. And women work. I see it with my son and his wife, who both work, and they have a small child, and tremendous economic pressure, tremendous social pressure. And at the end of the day, I actually don't feel bad for my new little granddaughter, but I feel bad for my son and his wife, who are working incredibly hard without the social support around them in terms of institutions supporting working mothers, right? And she works at a great place. She works at LinkedIn. They're terrific. But most places don't have on-site childcare, that kind of thing. So, and I do think there's been a loss of community where, whether that's going to temple or church or the Rotary Club or whatever, as people became more competitive, it became a loop. You didn't have time for community activity.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Madeline Levine is our guest. She's a clinical psychologist and author of a new book, Ready or Not, Preparing Our Kids to Thrive in an Uncertain and Rapidly Changing World. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowayne. We're talking about advice for parenting in anxious times. And again, our guest is psychologist Madeline Levine. And she has advice about raising kids to become more confident, more optimistic, more resilient adults. And again, her new book is titled Ready or Not. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. I still don't understand, though, where all this, whether you call it competitiveness or perfectionism or demanding or sort of over-involved parenting, where that came from. What is that a reaction to?
You know, it's sort of like an idea about scarcity. And I go back to the economics of this country, that the resources are scarce, that there's only a tiny group of people who share disproportionately in the resources. So I think that I'm not an economist, mm-hmm. but I think that drove a lot of people. concern about things like AI replacing jobs. I went around the country. This book took 4 years to write. It was a long time. And that was because I was so curious. I've talked to you before about, you know, kids of privilege having difficulty. And it's not just me. I mean, there's a whole group of people who have spent the last decade sounding that warning. And instead, instead of rates improving, our rates of anxiety have gotten worse. The World Health Organization, 1 in 3 kids and 1 in 3 adults
are feeling anxious.
Not are feeling anxious, are suffering from an anxiety disorder, which is different than feeling anxious. We all were supposed to feel anxious. And I think one of the things parents are having tremendous trouble with is tolerating the fact that kids need to feel anxious in their lives in order to master challenging things. And I think that's being taken away from kids. It's the biggest problem that I see. And because so many, I mean, 1 in 3 is
and that's astounding.
It's astounding. And we're talking about impairment. We're not talking about, you know, your kid rolls her eyes at you or cries after she's not invited to a party. We're talking about real impairment.
You mentioned the College Admission bribery scandal, and, you know, people are going to jail, and I think absolutely legitimately so, for basically, you know, faking test scores and faking applications and all of that. But as I've read about that and I've even watched these people going in and out of courtrooms, I think, what do their children think? I mean, that the parents would fake, you know, a picture on someone else's head to get them on a rugby team or something like that. Yeah. What is the message to children when parents cheat at that level to get them into what they consider the best or elite schools?
I think that first of all, I think it's very complicated. I think this has been addressed generally in a superficial way to this extent that kids have always had an advantage when they had money. That's the much or athletic prowess or whatever. That's a much bigger issue than these couple of nutty parents sort of doing this. And what does a kid think? It's the biggest vote of no confidence you can give a kid is you can't even you're 18 and you're not capable of filling out an application and getting into a college. I can't think of a greater vote of no confidence. How much these kids knew or didn't know, I have no idea. Apparently, there one of the guys was on TV saying he really – several people, they really didn't know. They really didn't understand that they were actually cheating. And it's like, maybe.
That's hard to believe.
Yeah, it is really hard to believe. And it's hard to believe it's the first time that they have assumed that money buys influence. And money does buy influence, but you don't want to do that. It is a model of moral behavior for your children. It's terrible.
I mean, obviously that's an extreme example, but, you know, taking it down to what we call snowplow parents, these are ones that kind of make sure that there's no obstacles in their children's path or, you know, the tiger moms or, I mean, I sort of hate these words, but you know, that's how we talk about it or even helicopter parents, there is this message, I think, implicit to their children.
Right. There is. But by the way, somebody just asked me to differentiate those. They're just the nom de jour for interfering parents. You know, and snowplow has, which is current now, sounds like more pervasive than just hovering. But they're all kind of the same thing. So, sorry. So what is it that parents are doing when they do too much for their kids? You think about how you learned to, you and I chatted a little before the show about, you know, we did different things. I was
growing
a teacher,
up.
Right. Or even as a young adult, I was a teacher. I really was a terrible teacher, but I was good at going home with kids. So that taught me I shouldn't teach, but maybe I should talk to people. I mean, this idea of falling down, which we're actually pretty good with. I know you have a young grandchild and I have a young grandchild. So I'm watching her learn to walk again, which I saw with my 3 boys.
Sure.
Falls down constantly. Her parents are great. They say she looks right at them and they say, you're okay. And she gets up again, takes a guy, falls over and over again. And nobody thinks to say to her, oh, my God, are you okay? Or if you keep falling down, you're going to be flipping burgers for the rest of your life. I mean, that's just not what we do with children. We like them babbling. We don't say, don't talk to me until you can talk in full sentences. We understand the trial and error that goes into learning when you're a child, but we lose that. We think there's too much at stake. Many parents think there's too much at stake to allow those kinds of mistakes in childhood. And
teenagehood, or maybe even young
right,
adulthood.
Right, that's right. And by the way, this past year, I probably sent 6 or 7 kids to what we call emerging adulthood programs, which never existed before. And those programs at psychiatric facilities are for kids who really never learned how to manage both their feelings and their life. So they cost a fortune, and they're for kids who had their bed made, doesn't know how to make a meal, doesn't know how to deal with the fact that they've been rejected. I had a good experience before I came here. I launched the book in New York. No, in San Francisco. I was just in New York. And I had a big audience, and I asked how many people in this audience of 600 people never had their heart broken. And one brave soul raised her hand. So maybe there were 2 or 3. Yeah. But, you know, it was all parents. You're going to have your heart broken in life. And we know that that's often part of kids who die by suicide. It's around grades. It's around parents. It's around confidence. And it's around breakups. So how do you get to being able to tolerate? And you're sad and unhappy, but you tolerate that broken heart at 18 or 28 or whenever it happens to you. You get to that place by being allowed to tolerate small doses of disappointment and sadness along the way. So I think in the book I use the example of a young lady who's left out of the popular party. You know, she's 12 or something. The parent steps in and says, oh, I'm so sorry, sweetie, let's do another party and we'll make it cooler and your friends will come to that instead. She's trying to attenuate her daughter's sadness and sense of rejection and all that stuff. But what is she doing? She's robbing her of the opportunity, painful as it is, to learn that she can survive not being invited to a party. And these kinds of experiences where parents are constantly coming in and trying to do away with challenge, sadness, rejection, disappointment, I think those muscles must be developed as you grow up.
Well, let me ask you how you do that. Using that as an example, the girl is not invited to the party of her classmates.
Right.
What does a parent say to that child then?
So I think what the first you acknowledge she's sad. I think parents don't listen enough, and I'm sure that was true of me as a parent as well. No child has ever come into my office, or teenager or young adult, and said, you know, my parents listen too much. Like, that just doesn't happen.
They wouldn't be in your office, would they?
Right, that's exactly right. They come in and say, my parents didn't listen. Talk too much, lecture too much. So I think we first listen to what she has to say. And if she's a young teenager, she might have very little to say. You know, she may roll her eyes, go into her room and slam the door. But the question opens the door for her. And you might tell the story of your own disappointment. One of the things I did for years with my kids when I was on the road was I would call after every talk I gave and tell them what went wrong. Because every interview you do, every speech you give, something like today my voice isn't good, right? There's always something.
But you would tell them.
I would tell them every time. And it's not all I tell them. Oh, it was great. I was in wherever and had a great conversation or a great audience. And by the way, the mic didn't work. Or I tripped over the wire, whatever. Because that doesn't end. You know, your kid looks at you and thinks you're incredibly competent. And you may be more competent than the kid, but there's still all kinds of things that get in your way. And you manage them over the course of a lifetime. And I think kids don't get that feedback. They see their parents as successful, period, and themselves as, struggling. And I think it's important to sort of tell them that that there will be challenges always and you can handle it. So back to that young girl, I mean, I think the other message is some form of, I think you can handle this.
Right, right, because I know you're a competent person and and have the skills to do that. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. Madeline Levine is our guest. She's a clinical psychologist, and she's written several books with a similar message from all those books about how to be a more, or I should say, less anxious parent and how to raise less anxious children. Her new book is called Ready or Not. Let me read a couple of comments. We've got one from Tabitha. I'm a college professor, and I see this stress manifested in my students in my own experience coming from an under-resourced family and being a first-generation college student. When I got into grad school at Penn, I realized I benefited by not knowing who I was competing against. Mm-hmm. But just sort of talking about, and maybe it is more, you know, middle class families that can find that happier medium for their children.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when my kids were growing up, if the kid next door had a problem in math, so my son, who was good in math, would go over and help out. I mean, that was the zeitgeist. That was the culture 30 years ago when he was little, young. And now the culture is more like if you are losing, that's good for me. If you're not good in math, that's good for me. If you get into, you know, Harvard, that lowers my chances. Everything is this mentality of scarcity. And it doesn't serve kids well, because the biggest thing that people have asked for in their workforce is collaborators.
That's true.
Every CEO I spoke to, collaboration.
Let me read something else from your book. You write, kids are not served by being kept away from what makes them anxious, and neither, by the way, are college students. The advent of trigger warnings, these are professors giving notice to students that some reading material may be troubling, is a particularly misguided trend. Why so?
My kids don't love that, but I feel that very strongly. When you're a psychologist, psychiatrist, mental health worker, and somebody is afraid of something, the last thing you're going to do is exclude that thing from their consciousness, right? So we do what's called progressive desensitization. You're afraid of spiders, or you're afraid of bridges or driving or whatever. Little by little, you get exposed to it and you learn some techniques for soothing yourself as you confront challenging situations. Progressive desensitization and cognitive behavioral therapy, mm-hmm. which is how you think about those situations, are very, very successful in lowering lots of things, but particularly distressing thoughts.
Even things like sexual assault, I mean, where someone has had a traumatic childhood.
Yes, we use the same thing, and we might use EMDR. I don't do that, but there are
eye movements,
right? Yeah. There are treatments for that, because it impairs you. So my thought about a college campus is, if you stay away from everything that's disturbing to you, that's not the college experience as I know it. The college experience as I know it is a place to explore who you are, what makes you nervous, what doesn't make you nervous, what you like. I think kids are infinitely more robust than we give them credit for. And I think the idea that they need to be protected at the beginning of anything, my youngest just graduated law school, the trigger warnings in there. I want my lawyer to have been to every class. You know, I didn't want him to miss the one class that I need help with. So I think it's treating kids like they're more fragile than they are. And there should be services. If, you know, a lot of it is around sexual abuse and stuff like
Absolutely.
That, there needs to be services, concurrent services, to deal with that child or that young adult's anxiety.
When I read that, it reminded me of the fairy tales I used to read to my son when he was little. And fairy tales are really frightening.
Yeah.
I mean, children being eaten and
right. lost,
fattened up and being lost. And yet children seem to really have a hankering for these particular stories.
Right. And I think that's because those stories read the child's mind. I mean, young children are, there's lots to be afraid of. They're little and the world is big. That's every child who's ever said there's a monster in my closet or under my bed or whatever. So I think fairy tales talk to children in a way that few other books do, which is these are your fears and this is how you work with them. So they leave breadcrumbs to get back, or they get out of the house, or they let their hair down. I mean, there's all kinds of solutions after the frightening thing. And I think that's what we need to make clear to kids, that there are some things you don't control, but the things you do control, you know, take it by the reins and confront it. And in that process, you develop a skill set. And it may be different for different kids. Some kids may withdraw a little bit. Some kids may learn more. Some kids may get very active. There's just a wide range of coping skills, but you better have a set of them.
Almost up on a break here, but let me read one more comment from Carmen. I feel validated by Dr. Levine's comment on the loss of joy in parenting. As the mother of two small children and a psychologist myself, I'm constantly trying to remind myself of what my girls need regarding nurturing and connection versus getting out the door on time. I mean, it's hard being a working parent.
Very hard. Very, very, very hard. And this will address an issue that's really important to me, which is how does the parent tolerate their own anxiety and have a life that looks enviable, enjoyable, fun to their children?
Well, let's take that break, and I want to pick up on that. Talking with Madeline Levine, she's a clinical psychologist, wrote a book called The Price of Privilege, also Teach Your Children Well, and her new book is titled Ready or Not, Preparing Our Kids to Thrive in an Uncertain and Rapidly Changing World. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. Pick up the phone. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. After this short break, we'll be talking about moms and dads. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with psychologist Madeline Levine. We've been talking about parenting styles that really create anxiety and sometimes even depression in children, and talking about over-parenting can have the reverse effect of making kids feeling more anxious, even more depressed. And again, her new book is called Ready or Not. And it does provide a kind of a roadmap for parents to help their kids become more confident, optimistic, resilient when living in this uncertain world. And I do want to get back to our commenters here, but I want to pick up on moms and dads, because you do differentiate being a mother and a father in this book. And it feels as if women, moms, are feeling this pressure more than dads.
So I think a lot of the work has become much more shared between mothers and fathers versus when we were raising our children. I think that's a great thing. I think the emotional labor of parenting still falls largely to women. And that is, when that gets shared, really, it'll be quite different.
Right.
But I think moms are just, most of them work. Most of them are trying to keep in some kind of reasonable shape. Most of them are raising one, two, three, some number of children. And I think that they have lost a sense of community when, I had kids, you know, we all met at the playground and we all had mom's groups. And I think there's less of that because there's no time for it. But I think one of the things that happens is when we're not having any fun, that shows. And one of my favorite stories in the book is a bunch of us, when you have three boys, it means you're doing a lot of, you know, soccer, lacrosse, and theater for my middle son, Mikey. And so week after week after week, my husband was in one part of California doing lacrosse, and I was in the other part doing soccer. And it's nice. It's a community. It's one of the few communities I actually had when my kids were young. But you know, by the 100th game, you're bored and everybody's up in the stands, like reading their book or their Kindle or their iPhone. And my son, Jeremy, at that point comes over to this group of women and says, you know, the field right next to us is free. Why don't you go play? And that was an incredibly important moment because I talked to a lot of kids after that, and the consensus, there were some kids who would have been distraught if their parents didn't come, but most kids couldn't care less. And they sort of said things like, you know, my dad comes every week. He works all week. He's on his BlackBerry back then, and then he spends the entire weekend watching me kick a ball. And I can't think of a less encouraging view of adulthood.
Absolutely. There's no fun.
Right. There's no fun. And I think this is what kids see is anxiety, and no fun. And I say in the book, if I had it to do over again, mm-hmm. I still would have gone to games, some of the games, not all of them, because it meant I neglected my friends, my husband, my own development. We act towards women like our development is over the day we gave birth. So you go to the bookstore or Amazon or Barnes, whatever, and there's 100 or 1,000 books on child development and parenting in terms of the child, and there's nothing on the fact that women need to keep developing because we're living a long time over the next 40 years.
And having friends and a social life and exploring and doing new things. Let me get a couple of callers into the conversation. We've got some more comments as well. We've got Maria, and she's calling us from Wilmington, Delaware. Maria, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I'm a parent whose child in college has been diagnosed with anxiety. Oh. And as a parent, that was very hard for me. Mm-hmm. And I think I got a little depressed and anxious because they recommended that she takes medication, low-dose medication. And I wish I'd heard this conversation maybe 10 years ago or so. But I feel like as an African-American, we have the same push as immigrants do mm-hmm. to towards success. And I see her press towards perfection, and even though I tell her she doesn't have to be perfect at all, I wonder if my lifestyle has indicated that is the goal.
Well, you sound like
so as a parent, it's been very hard for me.
You sound like a good parent, Maria. Let me give Madeline Levine a chance to respond.
Right. So, Maria, the first thing to keep in mind is that 30% to 40% of anxiety disorders are genetically determined. So I don't want you feeling that, God, this was all me and I did it wrong, because that's not the way it works. So most of us have some kind of gene floating around in us. There's somebody in our family who's anxious or depressed or bipolar, you know, somewhere. And whether or not that exhibits itself, your daughter's anxiety, that has something to do with environment, but not just your environment. Your daughter's in college, she has friends, she went to school. Anxiety disorders are, I'm sorry that happened, because for a parent, of course, it's upsetting, but we can treat anxiety disorders quite well. And I'm not sure which medication, low dose, it was probably something called an SSRI or Zoloft, something like that. And they're very effective. So I'd worry a little bit less about your daughter. I'm a little concerned about you because you said you find it very upsetting. But with a little bit of treatment at school and perhaps a little bit of medication and somebody helping her with a skill set, she should be okay.
Maria, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get Ruthie from Philadelphia to join us. And Ruthie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Can
Hi there.
You hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi. So I just kind of wanted to bring up the issue of kind of the reverse side of this coin. My parents were lovely people and were very much, you know, hands off, let me learn my own lessons. But on the other hand, I lived in a community full of these snowplow parents. So as a result, it was also very socially isolating when your parents are saying, hey, you know, figure it out yourself. And all the other parents are like, hosting birthday parties, et cetera. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about that, about, you know, the fact that you can't kind of pretend like you live in a world where no one else is a helicopter parent, because that can just be so socially isolating for the student or the child.
I'm with you. I appreciate the call. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just curious, Ruthie, you said it was socially isolating for you as you were growing up?
Yeah, it was, in that, you know, a lot of parents would drive their kids to extracurricular activities, and my parents worked, or, you know, parents were very involved in school and my parents weren't, things like that. So it was definitely strange in our community to have not a snowplow parent.
Right.
Fair enough. Yeah, thanks, Ruthie.
Did you feel neglected?
Sorry?
Did you feel neglected?
You know, I think on paper I really wasn't, but compared to my peers, I definitely felt like something was different.
Uh-huh. And was there any benefit to that for you?
You know, I think that at the end of the day, I'm really capable, and I've been doing my taxes since I was 15. I'm sure I've accidentally committed some tax fraud. And so that's really wonderful. But on the other hand, there's definitely some pain that comes with feeling really isolated from your peers and moving forward into adulthood, holding on to that.
Right. Yeah, fair enough, Ruthie. Thanks. Yeah.
Do you have children yourself, Ruthie?
No, I'm 25.
Oh, you're a young one. Okay. So you know, it's not one or the other. I think kids need to feel, especially in adolescence, not different than their peers. That's an important part of adolescence. But my guess is, in the process of having to depend on yourself more, and I hope that your parents were supportive of you, that you learned independence and a degree of confidence. And, you know, is that something you can chat with them about now? You don't have your own children yet, so it would be nice to get that kind of worked out for yourself before you do.
To have that conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we definitely talk about that a lot, actually. And it's an interesting conversation to have with them about that balance between, I want my kid to be independent, and I want my kid to also feel supported. And we talk about that all the time. It's very interesting.
Great.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I think you raised up several really good points, Ruthie. It also reminded me of something called free range kids, and we've done shows about this. We even did a show about, I think they're called savage playgrounds, but these are playgrounds where adults are not there.
Right.
Children are climbing trees and setting things on fire and, you know, hauling mattresses around. So there is this part of raising children. Maybe it's a reaction to all this control and perfectionism. What do you think of that?
So that's Lenore.
Yes, Scanese.
With free-range children. And those playgrounds, a lot of them are in England. I don't know that we have many of them here. That's the way kids grew up for a very long time. And, you know, everybody's afraid of injury. I would have been afraid of injury. More kids are injured proportionately playing organized sports than they are in these kinds of environments. So it's not like they're running around with buzzsaws and no supervision.
Maybe a hammer, but yeah.
Well, but they're taught to use tools. And, you know, kids like, where does your sense of competency come from? I'm not suggesting that you hand your 4-year-old a hammer, but could you hand a 10-year-old a hammer and teach them how to use it? Yes, you could. Remember, somewhere around 7 years old, kids begin to think in a more sophisticated way.
Yeah.
They can think logically. So you can say, if you do this, then this will happen to a child. And I think kids miss opportunities. You know, bike riding comes up all the time. I did a talk with Dan Pink a couple of years ago, and we asked in San Francisco, at what age would you let your child ride a bike? Thinking it was going to be 8 or 9, which is when we all rode bikes. And the average age was 12 or 13. Well, 12 or 13 is like late in the trajectory, because we were kidding around at the time. The reality is kids start having sex on average in this country at 16. 13 to 16 is not enough time to get all the work you need done about intimacy and the opposite sex and how to talk and stuff like that. So,
and learn to ride a bike.
And learn to ride a bike, right? Exactly.
Let me read an email from Nancy. One thing I noticed as a high school teacher is that students don't take responsibility when they do something wrong. Their parents have insisted that their child can do no wrong, and kids do not learn how to deal with their responsibility when they do something wrong. And mm-hmm. I think parents, teachers will say, you know, if they give a child, not all children or all parents, but if a child gets a B minus, they might hear from the parents who are saying, my child is an A plus parent.
Right. Isn't that was a great Freudian slip.
That is.
I'm a great A plus parent is
go.
Really the
okay.
argument. Yes. So it's problematic. This is not going to get solved here today. It's not going to get solved by one part of the puzzle, which is parenting. Having been a teacher, and not a very good one, which is why I'm a psychologist, I understand that it's incredibly frustrating. Parents bring their kids' forgotten homework up to school. You shouldn't do that. Don't bring your child's forgotten homework up to school because it says that the kid is incapable of remembering. And I don't like to guarantee, but I can promise you, for most kids, if they forget their homework a couple times and they get a zero and you don't interfere with that, that they will start remembering their homework.
Hmm. We have a couple of minutes, and I want to see if I can squeeze one or two more comments in. But just
sure.
looking ahead, and in many ways, this is about how to create resilient, optimistic, happy, productive, successful, however people define it,
right.
adults.
Right.
Is there one sort of piece of advice that you would have for parents to at least move their child in that direction?
So I would say listen more. I would say have some part of your life that's not entirely child-centric, so your kid actually wants to grow up. Don't micromanage. You can always come in afterwards if your kid can't do something. But I was recently asked by a CEO in Silicon Valley, should my child make a bed? Learn how to make a bed, which is a stunning question to me. His point was he doesn't make his own bed, the CEO. And the idea is not how your kid is right now in your house. It's not a still. Raising children is not stills, pictures. It's a movie. And so if your kid doesn't learn how to make his bed, his girlfriend will say, what the heck is the matter with you? Go make the bed. Or his roommate will say, go make the bed. So we need to think of parenting as like a 30-year trajectory, not what happened today. It will be ephemera very soon, mm-hmm. whether your kid got an A minus or a B plus on their social studies test.
An email from Emily. We have about a minute here. My 5 and 7-year-old girls are overscheduled ice skating lessons, gymnastics, tennis, swimming, and fencing. I feel like I'm throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks while developing body confidence and strength. Can you help define what balance in this respect looks like?
So 5 and 7-year-olds learn a lot about their bodies by hanging around and playing and being on the floor and the playground and stuff like that. Don't overschedule your child. It cuts out all the time for things like playtime, downtime, family time. That's our mantra, challenge success, that kids should have that every day. I'd let a kid of that age pick one activity mm-hmm. And do one activity and spend the rest of their time playing. And I know the community zeitgeist may be kids in multiple activities. It's not good for your child.
We're going to leave it there. Madeline Levine, thanks for joining us today on Radio
pleasure.
Times. And again, her book is titled Ready or Not, Preparing Our Kids to Thrive in an Uncertain and Rapidly Changing World. And she is a clinical psychologist with a private practice out in California and co-founder of Challenge Success, which is affiliated with Stanford's Graduate School of Education. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Henson. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for those calls and comments.